Thank you, Chris. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. It's the first time I've attended these meetings, and I appreciate the opportunity for an animal scientist to come speak to the group. And certainly in sunny California, it's a nice time to come. I think the reason that we're here today is certainly we're all familiar that there's consumer interest in grass-fed beef products. We're seeing information, you can find that in mass media here, happens to be Prevention Magazine, where they put grass-fed beef best, organic, and then lean beef. So we know that there's some demand for this product out there, and I think the big question is, can we produce a palatable product? What are those nutritional differences when we get done relating to human nutrition? And how do we make that work? What management systems do we use to get that animal finished and ready for consumption? So today what I'm going to share with you are the results of some of our research that we've been doing, looking at and trying to answer some of these questions as to how the forage finishing system impacts composition. First, before I get into research data, I want to spend a little bit of time and background just on fatty acids, their relationship to human health, and also conjugated linoleic acid and anti-carcinogen. That way, when I present some of the results, it'll make a little bit more sense to you. So kind of just a slight introduction here. I'm supposed to stay on time, which is typically a challenge for me some days. So Chris is going to pull me off the stage here and make sure that I stay on time. But let's talk about the differences in fatty acids and their relationship to human health. And so if we wanted to put them in categories, you might think that the good, the bad, and the ugly, but it's not really ugly, it's indifferent, I guess, on the end. And so if we think about some of the good fats, why they're termed that is because diets high in these types of fatty acids, when consumed by humans, would decrease LDL, or bad cholesterol, and increase HDL, or good cholesterol, in our blood. So they have beneficial effects that are going to help us ward off coronary heart disease. And in this category would be a monounsaturated fatty acid, so they had a one double bond, omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids, so they're going to have three or more double bonds, and omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acids. And you'll notice that I put a little asterisk by omega-6 fatty acids, because if we compared these to monounsaturated fats and polyunsaturated, the omega-3 fatty acids, what we would find is omega-6 fatty acids can also decrease HDL cholesterol. So of the three, they're probably the lowest on that poll. They reduce LDL, but they also tend to reduce HDL. So it could be a question as to whether we want to put those in a good category or not. There's a lot of debate going on, certainly in the health community, between these omega-3 and omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acids. The bad guys are going to diets high in these types of fatty acids are going to increase LDL cholesterol. And typically, media or someone would make a blanket statement that this is all total saturated fatty acids. And that's not true to lump them all into one category, because they really don't all behave the same. And so we need to talk about not just total saturated fatty acids, but to look at them individually or to group different ones together. And the ones that are the worst in terms of increasing LDL or bad cholesterol are myristic, palmitic, also lauric acid as well, but we don't see much of that in beef composition. So myristic is C14 and palmitic is C16. Diets high in these specific saturated fatty acids will increase bad cholesterol. Also, we know now that all the time we were told that butter was bad for us and margarine was wonderful, that somebody didn't know the whole story, right? And now we know that trans fatty acids are probably one of the worst things that we could have consumed in the world. So they have a very significant impact on increasing LDL cholesterol. But there is some... we need to kind of distinguish a little bit here between kind of man-made trans fatty acids, which are made when we take a vegetable oil, we react it with a base, and we make trans fatty acids a very different chain length, versus those that are made in the rumen of the animal, where we get kind of natural trans fatty acids that are made. Those are beneficial because they can actually be converted to some of our anti-carcinogenic compounds, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And then neutral, this is one of the other saturated fatty acids, stearic acid, 18-carbon fatty acid, that actually does not alter LDL cholesterol. So it gets somewhat complicated sometimes, I know, to talk about this story, because we can't just put them all in categories and say, well, saturated fat did this, mono did this, and poly did that. We have to break those apart and talk about the individual fatty acids and the impact that they have on health. And so I'm going to try to do that as we go through the presentation. The other one is that most of you are probably aware of conjugated linoleic acid, I imagine, right? Especially the cysteine trans 11 isomer and its potential benefits of fighting cancer, many different types of cancer. But that's really part of the story, again, and not the whole story. Here we have a cow. This happens to be data from grain-fed beef, and that's why you'll see that she's eating linoleic acid here, okay, in this picture, C18:2, okay, which is cis9, cis12 fatty acid. So if she's eating a grain diet in terms of corn, that's what she would, that's what that animal would be eating. When it goes to the rumen, the rumen microbes don't like those polyunsaturated fatty acids, so they do all they can to hydrogenate them. In this process, then they make two intermediates. Okay, so first, one is CLA, cis9:11 isomer, and I'm going to focus mostly on that one today. They can make other isomers at this point in time that have different effects, but the cis9:11 isomer is the one with the anti-carcinogenic effects and the one we want to focus on. The second step after that, then, is that it'll hydrogenate the cis bond to leave us with trans-11-vicinic acid. Now, most of you probably haven't heard about this one, but it's probably as important or more important than CLA. And again, when I show you the data later in this presentation, you'll see why, because we have more trans 11 available in the system than we do CLA. And then it can go all the way to be saturated to stearic acid. Now, if we look at the actual amounts flowing to the small intestine for absorption, and these are as percentage of dietary linoleic acid consumed, you can see some will come through unhydrogenated. So some linoleic acid passes through the rumen to the small intestine for absorption, about 22% of the total in the diet. If you look at CLA, that actually passes out of the rumen, 0.2%. So a very small amount is actually created in the rumen. If we look at trans-11, C18-1, trans-11-vicinic acid, you see 3%, much more coming out as trans-11 than as CLA, as these intermediates. And of course, the majority goes to stearic acid. Then the important part of that is then when we look at adipose tissues, then Anyo is going to talk about dairy, and this would be true in the lactating mammary gland as well, is that in the adipose tissue in the mammary gland, there's an enzyme, it's a delta-9 desaturase, that puts a double bond back in. Okay? And it actually converts that trans-11-vicinic acid to conjugated linoleic acid. And we now know that in milk and in meat, over 80% of all the CLA that is present is produced through this route, is desaturated from trans-11-vicinic back to CLA. And that's how we have CLA in the tissues or in the milk. So very interesting, and again, somewhat of a complex story to explain to everyone. But again, we need to be looking at, I think, both intermediates and not just only focusing on one. The other part of this is that as humans, we have this same desaturase enzyme. And so if we eat a diet containing trans-11-vicinic acid, our adipose tissue, our bodies, can desaturate that too as well and make CLA. So that's an important point of the story too as well. Okay, so what I want to do is share with you today some of the data that we've obtained as part of the pasture-based beef systems for Appalachia. And that's a collaborative research group between USDA ARS, Dr. Bill Clapham at Beaver, West Virginia, and his team there, West Virginia University and Virginia Tech University. Clemson also comes in on the sideline. I do all the meat quality analysis for the project. And so we've been going now, Bill, I think it's 10 years that we're on now, and conducting research at, we started out first comparing grass-fed and grain finishing systems, And currently now we're just kind of looking at mostly just grass finishing systems, what forage is, how do we manage that to produce the best product. So the first 3 years of the study, we finished almost 200 head of Angus steers. Those steers have been backgrounded at different rates of gain. I'm not going to include that data because there really was no impact whether they gained a half a pound a day or a pound and a half a day, except on weight. There was no difference on meat quality characteristics. And then after the backgrounding phase, those steers were either put in the feedlot and fed a grass silage grain concentrate ration or put on pasture in West Virginia for finishing. One of the important parts of this study we've done is that we harvested at a similar animal age endpoint, not a physiological endpoint. And I get in trouble a lot for this in animal science. I'm not sure about the crowd today, whether we'll have some disagreements over that. But I kind of feel like a grain-fed and grass-fed cattle are like apples and oranges. We can't make them look the same very easily. You know, either you're going to have short feed your grain-fed cattle so you keep them at 2/10 of an inch of back fat, or you're going to feed your grass-fed cattle forever to try to get them up to 3 to 4/10 of an inch of back fat, or to try to get them to 1,350 pounds that we finish our grain-fed animals. And so to me, you can't really finish those two equal endpoints. It just doesn't happen with the difference in energy that they're taking in. And when we do that, we confound the system by either having younger animals or older animals that we're making a comparison to, and that impacts palatability of that product, and I'll show you some data today. So just remember when you're looking at this, what we've done is when we ran out of grass, everybody went to town, okay? So they were all finished for the same period of time, the grain-fed and the grass-fed. So there were certainly true compositional differences, true size differences in those animals. And if you're interested in any of this information, we have several publications in the Journal of Animal Science that you can go and look that up. I can't share with you quite everything today, again, to stay on time. We take a whole rib. Those are slaughtered. Animals are slaughtered commercially. We bring a whole rib back, and then we do our compositional analyses on that. And so the data I present to you will be from a ribeye steak. Okay, so if we start looking at the information here, the data, this will be total lipid content of the ribeye steak. And most of these graphs are going to look the same, so I'll set it up for you the first time here. The yellow bar is concentrate finished, those finished on corn silage and corn. And the green bar will be those finished on grass, the mixed pastures in West Virginia. And we look at total lipid content. On a percentage basis, you would see concentrates about 4%. Whereas grass-fed would be about 2.4% total lipid. So when they were finished, not to a compositional endpoint, to the same age endpoint, we get a leaner animal. That's probably not surprising to everyone. They're not going to put on as much fat, not being getting such a high energy ration in the feedlot. So about a 42% decrease in the amount of total lipid. If we look at the bottom across that bar, there is the USDA grades for these cattle. Those finished on concentrate, over 80% choice. Those finished on pasture were 70% select. Okay, so they did not grade the same in this system. Now, if we look at total cholesterol content, even though the steaks were leaner that were finished off grass, there is no difference in cholesterol content. And this is probably one of the greatest misconceptions out there, is that lean meat means low cholesterol meat, and that's actually very untrue. It's a very small difference. We say 42% between grain and grass-fed, but we're talking about 4 versus 2% fat. That's a fairly small difference in terms of having an impact on total cholesterol, that steak, because cholesterol is in every cell membrane in our bodies and all mammals, okay? So it's in the muscle cell as well as in the adipose cell. And so just because we took a little bit of adipose out, we're not going to have a big impact on cholesterol content. And actually, I didn't put all the data in today, but if we looked at a boneless, skinless chicken breast amount of cholesterol, it's actually higher than beef. It's actually about 80 milligrams per serving than is beef at about 50-60. So just because it's lean does not mean it's low in cholesterol, and that's probably one of the things that most people don't understand. A lot of producers would put this on their website, and this would be something that you would see promoted. Fat-soluble vitamins, alpha-tocopherol and beta-carotene. We know that those are present in the forages, and so when animals consume those, they do deposit that in the muscle tissue. You can see tocopherol much higher for grass-finished than it is for grain-finished animals. Beta-carotene, not a huge difference. It is statistically higher for grass-fed than grain-fed, but it's somewhat of a minor difference, as you can see there, maybe not of physiological importance. Now, the importance of this, like tocopherol anyway, is going to help us with shelf life, and I'll show you some results on that in the next slide, how that impacts shelf life of the product. And so much so that now that feedlots are actually supplementing vitamin E in their rations to try to increase tocopherol in grain-fed cattle, because when you pull them off pasture, you lose so much tocopherol in that meat, has a big impact on how many days a product can be displayed at the grocery store, which in terms of the retailer means a lot of money. If he has to throw out that ground beef or that steak before it gets sold, that's a huge loss in the system. And so if you can have a product that has a couple more days of shelf life, that's a major savings for that retailer. And so the grain-fed people are actually supplementing tocopherol back in because of that. The beta-carotene is going to add to the yellow color, okay, of fat tissues. However, you can see there's not a large difference here in the amount of beta-carotene, and if most of you walked into the cooler and I had a grain-finished steer and a grass-finished steer, you probably could not tell me the difference of which one it is just looking at fat color. A lot of talk about the yellow fat of these steers. We're talking about very young animals, and visually, you cannot tell a difference. I can go in with some fancy equipment, a colorimeter, and I can measure B-star yellowness of that fat color, and I can get a statistical difference. Maybe it's like a 16 versus a 14, okay? So I can get a difference, but again, with the human eye, you cannot tell it. So we really don't see that yellow fat color that a lot of people talk about in grass-finished beef. And again, I think some of that goes back to the animal age. Where we slaughter these cattle is actually a cow plant, okay, where they're slaughtering cull cows. And you go in there and you will see yellow fat, as yellow as you want, on these older cows. And so it must be something where the beta carotene accumulates over time. And so as that animal gets much older, you would see a very yellow fat color to it. And some people may equate it to that, but that's because of it's on an old animal that's accumulated that much carotene in their fat tissue. We just don't see that in these young animals. It's very difficult to tell. If you had to visually go in and make a distinction between grain-fed and grass-fed based on fat color, not too many people could do it. It'd be almost impossible. Here's the difference in shelf life, and this happens to be a different study that we did finished some heifers on, but just to give you an idea, this is T-bars. That's the measure of lipid oxidation over display time, 0 to 10 days of display. And the white bar are some alfalfa finished animals. The green bar is animals finished on tall fescue, endophyte free, and the yellow bar is grain finished animals. Well, actually, it's grain supplemented animals on tall fescue. And so we talked about the differences in tocopherol. Okay, when we start to feed them grain, we see a reduction in tocopherol, and you see an increase in lipid oxidation, or a shortening of shelf life by feeding those animals grain. So it does impact shelf life of the product by having that enhanced tocopherol content in the muscle tissue. Getting into fatty acid composition on these animals, okay. And I'm showing this as a percentage of total fatty acids, so on a concentration basis in this slide. So if we look at those bad saturated fatty acids, which is SFA minus stearic, so that's myristic and palmitic acids, you can see just a slight reduction in the total percentage of myristic and stearic in the grass-fed beef ribeye steaks. If we look at stearic acid, the one that I talked about being a neutral saturated fatty acid, we see an increase in stearic acid for the grass-fed beef versus the concentrate-fed beef. So one, if I looked at total saturated fatty acids, what would happen if I added those bars together? it would actually look like there was more saturated fatty acids for the grass-fed. When we break those apart and we look at them in terms of their health impacts on human health, their impacts on human health, then we actually have less myristic and palmitic acids, the bad saturated fatty acids, and more stearic, a neutral fatty acid. So again, kind of why I talked about that at the beginning, why we need to look at these things somewhat individually versus just a total saturated fat content. You might say, well, why is there more stearic around? If you think back to that cow I showed and biohydrogenation, that rumen probably is functioning more, get more biohydrogenation, so we get even more conversion of those polyunsaturated fatty acids to stearic in the rumen and a greater amount of stearic acid in the adipose tissues. Monounsaturated fatty acids, we talked about those being a positive or a good fat. We see a reduction in grass-finished beef compared to grain-finished beef. And one thing you would see from feedlot cattle, especially the longer that you feed them grain, an increase in monounsaturated fatty acids. So the longer you feed grain, the increase you get in monounsaturated fatty acids. It's fairly well documented. Also, the longer you feed grain, the lower the omega-3 fatty acids go. So you get a lot of monounsaturated fat by feeding high grain diets. Coming back to look at conjugated linoleic acid and that trans-11-bacenic acid, and this is why I wanted you to take note of both of these compounds. Look at the difference in the amount of them as a percentage of total fatty acids. So in grass-fed beef, we're up somewhere around 3.2% of total fatty acids as trans-11-bacenic acid and only 0.7% as CLA. So there's a lot more trans-11-bacenic acid in those tissues than there is CLA, and that's why it's important to look at both of those. In the concentrate-fed animals, you see very little amount of trans-11-bacenic acid, and that's because it tends to take a trans-10 pathway of biohydrogenation, so we don't see as much trans-11-bacenic produced. Then if we look at it, what we call on a gravimetric basis, and this is going to be milligrams per serving, okay? And a serving, according to USDA and American Heart Association, is 3 ounces of cooked beef, okay? So that's like the size of your fist, a deck of cards. And so you think about that tonight while you have steak and say, oh, I wonder how many servings I just ate, you know. It certainly maybe is not representative of the human diet that we only eat a 3 ounce serving. So when you look at these things, maybe if you're eating a 6 or a 9 or a 12 ounce steak, you just multiply the difference here a few times. But that's what they say is a serving size, and so that's what we put the data on. So this is as eaten, a milligram of these fatty acids per serving, 3 ounce serving cooked of beef. And so the first thing you notice when you look at that CLA between the concentrate finished and the grass finished, they're pretty much the same, aren't they? How's that possible? I just showed you that the concentration was higher in grass fed, but what did the first slide, bar slide, graph slide show? Reduction in total fat, okay? So you got less total fat, you got a greater concentration. When you multiply those things together, you come up with about the same number. Okay, so there's not a huge difference in the total amount of CLA in beef between grass-fed and grain-fed per serving. Now remember back to all that trans-11-bacenic acid that was there, and you look at the milligrams of that that are present in that steak, over 70 milligrams versus just a little bit over 10 in grain-fed. And we know there's some research out there that suggests about 20% of this can be desaturated to CLA in human adipose tissues. So if you give it that bump for what's going to happen in the human body, where it desaturates that trans-11-bacenic to CLA, then you would see that, yes, there is a difference between the two. So again, a little bit more to the story, we have to talk about both trans-11-bacenic and CLA if you want to talk about some differences between the grain-fed and the grass-fed beef. We look at omega-3 fatty acids. I didn't show you that on a percentage basis. It's certainly difference in concentration. So everybody asks, well, what does that translate to on a gravimetric basis, milligrams per serving? What we're looking at is about 30 milligrams for concentrate finished and about 45 for grain finished. Is that a huge difference? Yes and no, maybe, right? You know, 14 milligrams difference between those two. Now, a couple points. Remember, one, how many of us are eating a 3-ounce serving? Okay, so if you're eating a 6-ounce, a 9-ounce, a 12-ounce steak, you can multiply that out, okay? So then it does get much larger because most of us are probably not eating that nice 3-ounce steak at all. The other thing is, how many times are we eating beef a day? I'm not sure on this crowd. I usually can, you know, in the animal science crowd, I can pretty well guess. If you're like me, you're eating beef 3 or 4 times a day. So I'm not just eating salmon once a month. I'm eating beef every day. And if I switch and eat grass-fed beef every day, then that would make a difference in my overall diet as to how much omega-3 fatty acids that I'm consuming. So I think those are some important points to think about as we look at that number. But likely, you know, omega-3 fatty, are we a source of omega-3 fatty acids in grass-fed beef? No, one serving is not going to supply your daily requirement for omega-3 fatty acids. And in comparison, salmon would have 1 gram or 1,000 milligrams of omega-3 fatty acids per serving. If we look, though, at the ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids, what you would find, though, is a difference where concentrate finished beef is about 4.8 to 1, so 4.8 times more omega-6 fatty acids than omega-3, whereas the grass-finished beef is going to be about 1.5, 1.6 to 1, so more closer to an equal balance. And according to health professionals, we should keep our ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids at less than 4 to 1, okay? And closer to 1 and 1, they say, is better. So we have an equal balance between omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids. And so you can see with grass finishing of cattle, we typically are about in that range where we're almost 1 to 1, just slightly over 1 to 1, less than 2 to 1. And if I had to pick one thing that we could actually analyze in the laboratory and differentiate between grass-fed and grain-fed, it would be the omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acid ratio. When cattle are finished on forages, we will see this ratio at almost a 2-to-1 or less. If you start to supplement, it will go above that. In conversations with USDA, although they didn't listen to me, I told them that that would be the one thing if you really wanted to distinguish a grass-fed beef product in the marketplace, it would be omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acid ratio that would probably be our best measure to do so. Now, what does that mean in terms of the 4-to-1 ratio? It's hard to know sometimes, is this going to make a difference in human health? And although we would love to do some human health studies, we haven't quite found the cash there yet for somebody to help us out. These trials can be very expensive to actually do a comparison in a human study between grain-fed and grass-fed beef. So we have to look at some of the data that's out there. The Lion Heart Study, they did a dietary intervention study in patients after their first heart attack. They went in and reduced their linoleic to linolenic acid ratio. So they reduced the amount of 18:2 in the diet and increased linolenic 18 with 3 double bonds. This is important for a couple reasons. One, we hear a lot of talk about fish oil fatty acids, right? The really highly unsaturated longer chain fatty acids, and people say, well, linolenic, it's omega-3 fatty acid, but it doesn't have that much benefit in human health. Okay, lots of times you'll hear that discussion, how much alpha linolenic is actually converted to omega-3 fatty acids, and is it really beneficial or not? So in this study, that's all they did was change linoleic to linolenic. There was no addition of fish oil fatty acids, okay? Just a simple change in that ratio by changing the amount of linoleic and linolenic. And they saw a 76% decrease in mortality after 2 years on the intervention diet. That kind of makes me think it does matter as to this ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids. 76% decrease in mortality after that first heart attack, just a simple change in diet, and that was ratio of those fatty acids. Not a change in total fat content that they were eating, not a change in cholesterol, those kinds of things, just simply a change in that ratio. And it also was alpha-linolenic, not fish oil fatty acids, that did show to have some benefit. as I talked about us eating beef every day, if we think about other countries where they consume very large amounts of beef, even more than the U.S., and they're typically consuming grass-fed products, in Australia they've found that red meat can supply over 70% of the total dietary, and this is DPA, one of the fish oil type fatty acids. So because we eat so much beef, okay, and it has these attributes, then we can change how much we're consuming in our overall diet. Now, if we're concerned about these things, you probably shouldn't look at this slide. One thing that Bill, Dr. Clapton, challenged me to do was to make some comparisons to other proteins. And I first just went to the USDA book. There's a listing. There's a nutrient database. You can go look up composition of chicken, yada, yada. And I thought, well, I would never go there to get a beef number, so why am I going there to get a number for chicken or pork or whatever it may be? So we started a little grocery store survey. We go and sample every other week, and we analyze it in our lab under the same conditions that we're analyzing the beef samples. So if you look clear over to your far left, there's the grain-fed beef and the grass-fed beef numbers that I just showed you at about 5-1 and less than 2-1. Then there's a ribeye steak from the store, which is about 7-1. Then there's a pork chop, chicken breast, skinless, boneless, chicken breast, skinless, natural, chicken thigh, skinless, salmon farmed, and salmon wild. And you notice the numbers increase quite dramatically, don't they? As we get into a monogastric animal that's been fed corn and soybean meal. So pork chops at about 27-1. The poultries are around, you know, depending on which one you look at, about 12-1 to 20-1. And this is really, if you think about it, this is what's happening in our bodies as well. We are monogastric mammals, okay, much like a pig and a chicken. I know we don't want to be referred to as the, you know, in relationship to those animals. But what we eat is what's going to be deposited in our adipose tissues. And this is the whole discussion over this omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acid ratio, is that since we've gone to an industrialized food system, we get much more linoleic acid than we get the omega-3 fatty acids. And so if we looked at human adipose tissue, it'd probably look somewhere in that range, depending upon their diet, as a pork chop or a chicken. So we get out of balance on that omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acid ratio. Another interesting one is if you look at salmon farmed versus the wild salmon, of the comparison between the two, this is actually one of the greatest differences. It's a tenfold difference. So whatever they're feeding to their farmed salmon has some linoleic acid in it. So it has a higher linoleic acid to linolenic acid omega-3 ratio. Here's Warner Brasler shear force. And this is our objective measure of tenderness. These are aged either 14 or 28 days post-mortem, and you see that we have no difference in Warner Brasler shear force between our grain-fed and our grass-fed cattle. Again, I think this goes back to us slaughtering these animals at a similar age in point. But we produce very highly palatable product, and if you listen to the USDA grading system, which we know in the grain-fed business hasn't worked for the last 30, 40 years, you can see that those grain-fed cattle now were 80% choice, grass-fed cattle were 70% select, but they ate the same. Tenderness was the same. And we've seen that in the grain, in the traditional feeding systems, that USDA grade has no relationship to tenderness. Here's what we're currently looking at, and that's animal age at slaughter. So we've slaughtered these at 16, 18, and 20 months of age. These are all grass finished. There's no comparison in here to grain finished animals. This is shear force again, Warner Brasler shear force. And so remember, a higher number is tough and a lower number is more tender. As we get that animal older, the Warner Brasler shear force value increases. These are two different aging times. So the orange bar is Warner Brasler shear force at 14 days of aging. The purple bar is that at 28 days of postmortem aging. Okay, it's the difference between the two bars there. Typically, if we want to draw a line or look at the research data, they say roughly less than 3.5 kilos of shear force will result in a tender product. So you see, as the animal got to 20 months of age, and it was only aged for 14 days, that we exceeded that shear force value. It was greater than 3.5. Now, if we aged for 28 days, it fell below that line. So the older that we take these animals, the more important postmortem aging is in for palatability. But I think that probably if we think about the window of acceptability for our grass-fed animals, animal age is number one. We got to get these animals finished while they're young. We can't let them hang around forever. And if you think about back to all the old data that's out there, the older data literature on grass-fed versus grain-fed, most of the time they were finishing to a compositional, either a fat thickness endpoint or a weight endpoint. And what happened? Grain-fed cattle were younger, grass-fed cattle were older. Grain-fed cattle were more tender, grass-fed cattle were tougher. Why? Because of animal age. Not because of the grass finishing system, per se, okay, but because they were older, if you look at this, they would be tougher. So if we compared grain-fed at 16 months of age and grass-fed at 20 months of age, we would probably see the same values there. So we would see a tougher animal the longer we keep that animal around. Now, sometimes that really is a challenge for most of us, most grass-fed producers. They want to know, what should I finish this animal to? Should it have a certain fat thickness? Should it be a certain weight? And so far, what we've seen is fat thickness doesn't have that much relationship, marbling score doesn't have that much relationship, all these things. The most important thing so far has been animal age. So we need to get that animal finished in a short period of time. Now, I just want to, I'm getting a signal here to wrap up, and I'm still going as usual. So just want to talk a little bit about forages, and there's a question. These are some different ones that we looked at: alfalfa, Bermuda grass, chicory, cowpea, and pearl millet. These are animal gains, and for some reason my label didn't show up. It's average daily gain kilogram per day. For us in the summer months in South Carolina, trying to get something finished is quite a challenge because it's so hot, kind of like California here. So we know that we can't get it done on Bermuda grass, and we wanted to look at other forages where we get greater gain. Here's our shear force values off those, and we saw an improvement with finishing on alfalfa and cowpea. So our legumes increased tenderness when we finished those in this project. And this was also reflected in the consumer panel that we did. If you look at the purple bar on preference, 40% of the panelists, 39% to be exact, preferred alfalfa finished beef compared to any of the others. Okay, so it really, those finished on alfalfa were just exceptional carcasses and were highly preferred by our consumer panel. Okay, here's a test, see if you were listening. Which one was supplemented with grain? Chris, why don't we talk just a minute on supplementation. So look at these three ribeyes. Is it number one, number two, number three? Show of hands. Which one received grain? They were on forage, but they were supplemented with grain on forage. How many think one? Okay. How many think two? How many think three? Oh, and you're the agronomist, aren't you? I'm very concerned now because the first one was finished on alfalfa. The second one was grain on grass, had been supplemented for 56 days, and the last one was endophyte-free tall fescue that the animal had been finished on. So we do see greater back fat deposition and greater marbling, actually, with the alfalfa-finished cattle. Now, here's what happened to omega-6 to omega-3 ratio as we supplemented those animals on tall fescue. And for some reason, my legend isn't, oh, there it is at the bottom. The blue bar is alfalfa. The red one is tall fescue, endophyte-free. And then the yellow bar is those that were supplemented with grain, a self-feeder of corn, on tall fescue, endophyte-free. And they were either supplemented for 56 or 84 days. So as we started to put that supplement on, the grass in the grass finishing system, okay, we see that we increased the omega-6 to omega-3 ratio. So that's how, as I talked about, what thing to differentiate between grass and grain-fed and whether something's been supplemented or not. Typically, you can tell by the omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acid ratio. And so I'll just summarize quickly. We saw it was a leaner product, does have increased omega-3 and CLA concentration, increased antioxidant content, and no difference in palatability. And as I said, I think that probably in terms of acceptability of this product, animal age is the number one factor that we found so far. So I think what that means is we need to get these animals finished, quote unquote, by about 18 months of age to have high palatability. And I think that puts a lot of pressure on the agronomists in the room because we need good forages to get that done. Okay, so the forage finishing system, we can't just throw them out in pasture and hope they gain and get going. We need some good forages. We need some good management to get those animals up to the weight we want them to be at 18 months of age. We've seen improvement with legumes and, as I talked about, with supplementation. So these are some things to think about for the future. And did you want questions or anything, Chris?
Yeah, 5 minutes for questions.
So some things, and what I just throw out to you is, you know, I don't know if we can alter the composition of forages very much, but it might be something very interesting.
Susan, you gave those research articles, but if you put together a good lay article or proceedings article to summarize some of this.
That's a really good idea, and in my spare time, I'm going to try to get that done someday. I've actually been talking to Bill about this project. We have just a wealth of data, and we haven't boiled something down into an extension or a layperson type document. We really need to do that. So with Bill in the room here, I guess I'll make sure we get that done. We kind of boil that down. We got a lot of information we need to do so.
The question in the back here.
Wonderful presentation, great stuff. Where can I find information about how much grain impacts CLA on the fatty acids? You know, 2 pounds, 5 pounds, 10 pounds. Where is it? Does it go to Sanker or go dramatically off the cliff? What goes on with the amount of production?
Okay, the amount of CLA, how much corn you're feeding and how it impacts CLA. There's just been a few studies done like that, and I'm thinking of Jennifer Gaze at Virginia Tech, where he did some subcutaneous biopsies, and Bill, I can't remember exacts on that, but they had biopsied over time after they put them on grain from grass, or the other way around, I don't remember.
I think they looked both ways, I believe.
Okay, so I think they switched some from pasture to grain, and then they sampled over time to see that change, and they took some from forage, you know, they flip-flopped them and looked at the change. And I think it was like 28 days that there was a difference. Once you took them off the feedlot, put them back on pasture, it was like changed in 28 days. But as for actual amount of grain, that'd be very limited information, I think, on that. Probably some more that needs to be done in terms of supplementation.
In the back corner there.
Is there any data out there on vitamin K as related to feeding
system? No, I don't know of any data on vitamin K, no. Something we need to look at, okay.
Question here.
So there is a huge difference in the omega 6 to omega 3 on the monogastrics versus the ruminant. In a typical American diet, if we switched all of our feed consumption from grain fed to grass fed, could you even detect the difference?
That's a good question. I guess it probably depend, you know, is that all you're eating? If you're not eating any chicken, then it would make a difference. If you're there's a few of us that don't consume poultry. But I mean, it would kind of depend on the overall diet. So it's hard to make that judgment. But you're right. If you looked at grain-fed beef, the difference between grain-fed and grass-fed beef is much smaller than chicken consumption or pork consumption compared to the others.
One more question.
About marketing, my boss is an animal scientist, and he says if I take my grass-fed 18-month to the sale barn, it's going to go back to the feedlot.
To the sale barn for marketing?
Yep.
Yeah, probably. If you're going to the sale barn, we have a lot of misconceptions of what a finished steer looks like, and I think that's one of the hardest parts for most of our producers. We think he has to have 4/10 of an inch of fat. He has to be 1,300 pounds, and it's very tough to make a grass-finished steer look that way. But when we get down to the end product, it doesn't necessarily make a difference. So we have these conceptions of what that animal should look like, but that isn't impacting product quality. So in order to take advantage of that, you're going to have to market it yourself. And I think Don's going to talk more about marketing and economics.
I know there's more questions, and we need to cut it off so we can get to our next speaker. But we're going to have some discussion time at the end of the symposium. And we'll bring all the speakers back up, and you guys save your questions for that time. Let's thank Susan for that wonderful presentation.